Under advisement, then we move to CN Corporation versus Gregory Kane.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Initially, I want to address the bankruptcy issue, and I don't know if that's on anybody's mind, but after I filed my initial brief, Illinois River Winery declared bankruptcy in this matter. I don't think it changes. I think it's immaterial. I don't think it changes the arguments with respect to this case.
Well, it does change what the outcome of this, immediate outcome would be, right?
Well, unless you're going to decide today or by next Tuesday, we have an agreed motion to lift the stay, and we presume that the bankruptcy court will enter that.
I think that'll probably come before we.
I searched high and low for whether we needed to lift the stay for cases in this circuit. I couldn't find any, so maybe I'm deficient in that respect. But there we go. Okay, so that issue aside. This case was about the name Hollow Wine. The name Hollow Wine is a term that was used by both the plaintiff and the defendant for a fall seasonal spiced wine, and it was an apple wine with spices. And so there was initially Illinois River Winery attempted to register the name Hollow Wine before the Patent and Trademark Office was unsuccessful. The registration was not allowed. Later, Door Peninsula Winery tried to register the name before the Patent Trademark Office. That registration was unsuccessful, was not allowed. This litigation then ensued with Door Peninsula Winery suing my client, Illinois River Winery, in an attempt to establish priority in the name Hollow Wine, in an attempt to establish that the name actually belonged to them.
Mr. Kasper.
Yes.
Your friends over at that table maintain that every issue raised in the appeal has been waived. And, of course, in our cases, we constantly hold that arguments that weren't presented to the district court in response to summary judgment motions cannot be considered on appeal. Can you identify with specificity where in the response to the summary judgment motion you raise these claims? Argument here.
Each of these issues? Mm-hmm. Okay. Judge, I have to start out with this simple notion, which is in the defense of cases in this country, the last time I checked, the plaintiffs have the burden of proof. If the plaintiffs don't meet the burden of proof, whether it's at trial or whether it's in summary judgment, I don't have to raise the issue.
But is it your understanding that defenses to summary judgment can't be waived because the movement has the burden of establishing the right to summary judgment?
Oh, absolutely.
And if there is a valid defense, that means the movement failed to meet that burden?
If I don't have I don't have to defend something that they haven't put in issue. It's that simple. If the plaintiffs do not put an issue,
could you give me the case support?
Sure. In the reply brief, Your Honor, if you take a look on.
See, here's the way I understand it. Once a movement has presented to the district court its argument for summary judgment, it's the responsibility of the non-movement to present any arguments against the granting of summary judgment. And the non-movement can't withhold arguments from the district court and then fall to district court on appeal for failing to independently recognize such potential defenses. And the district court, it seems, ruled on the summary judgment based on the arguments that were presented by both parties, and that's all we review on appeal. And it looks as if many of the arguments before us were not presented below.
Well, Judge, if you look at page 2 of my reply brief, I deal with this issue. And I cite the U.S. Supreme Court in the Anderson versus Liberty Lobby case, which indicates that the plaintiffs have the burden of proof. And you know what? I can walk into any trial court in this country, in any state, and if the plaintiffs do not meet their burden of proof, either in trial or summary judgment, I won't have a judgment entered against me. And it really is that simple. And if they raise a summary judgment issues, as they did in this case, and they don't meet all the elements necessary to get a judgment, it's not my obligation to raise those issues and say, look, fellas, you missed something. And that's exactly what happened in this case. I mean, they did, it's not my obligation to try their side of the case and my side of the case. My obligation is to try my side of the case. And that's been an axiom in the law of this country for 300 years. It's really that simple. And if you look at the Anderson against Liberty Lobby case, and frankly, if you look at the cases that we talk about where there's waiver of these issues, those cases are where plaintiffs failed to prove something, and then later on came back and argued that, hey, this is the issue, and this proves this, and this proves this, and the court says, no, you're waived. They're not in the position of a defendant who comes in and says, look, they never proved this. And if you're looking specifically at the issue of whether the mark is protectable, if it wasn't an issue in the case, why did the district court rule on it at page 17 of its opinion? I mean, it was an issue.
Mr. Kasper, can I give you two specific examples of this?
Sure.
So one example would be on the issue of your client getting tagged with the $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
It looks to me as if the law basically says the plaintiff's burden is only to come forward with the gross amount of damages. If the defendant wants to fight back on that with some exceptions or establish what the profit part of that is, it's the defendant's obligation. If the defendant fails to do that, in the district court, the defendant has waived that argument in the Court of Appeals. That's one thing. Okay, that's one example. Here's my other example is the one you're going to, which is whether it's a protectable mark. In that example, when I go to the briefs and the I don't know what you guys call 56.1 statements, but it's the facts you marshal in favor and opposed to summary judgment. In that context, what I see here is the plaintiffs have said we have a protectable mark, and here's the evidence for why this mark is suggested. And you've come back and you've got three specific paragraphs of your statement of additional facts that say it's not actually suggestive, it's generic, and here's some examples, some evidence of why we think it's generic. That's an example of preserving the argument because you came forward with your evidence that it's the other way. And maybe if I concretize it in that way, does that help try to answer Judge Rovner's question?
Yes, I mean, it was a little tough question for me to answer of hers because, it's a broad question. But yes, you're exactly right. One of the reasons that I didn't argue the first issue that you brought up was with respect to the amount of the damages was we did not come forward with the proof of cost of goods sold, and that's our problem. We didn't do that, and that is an argument that's waived. That's why I didn't bring it up here, because I agree it's waived. But with respect to the protectability of the mark, that was an issue in the case. The court decided it at page 17 of its opinion, and we put forth evidence in this case that this is a generic mark. We brought forth the fact that there were some 14,000 hits on Google for the term hollow wine. This is no different than Chablis, Chardonnay, Malbec, or anything else with respect to this name of wine. And for Thorpe Peninsula Winery to attempt to co-opt this name for its own has never been litigated, was not fully litigated, and there are facts that are in dispute here. So, Judge, with all due respect, I understand this waiver argument, and I hope that I have dealt with it to your satisfaction at page 2 of my reply brief. with respect to the citations I made there and this discussion. But I think Justice has adequately crystallized that argument for me. The second piece of this is whether Mr. Keene is personally liable for this judgment of $500,000. And the fact of the matter was that they didn't put in any evidence as to his liability. And again, Judge, I think this ought to crystallize for you what it is that a defendant needs to do or has to do in a case. Does a defendant need to come in and say, look, fellas, you haven't put in any evidence to show that Mr. Keene is not individually liable, therefore you're not entitled to a judgment? And I don't bear that responsibility. If this were a trial of the matter and they put on no evidence, they put on no evidence.
Is Mr. Keene, all I know about Mr. Keene is what I read in these briefs, so there's somebody put some evidence in here about Mr. Keene. And my question is, is he the only person who was involved in the management of this company?
It's not on the record, and I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, but it's not on the record. I mean, they have to make
it's asserted in the briefs that he is the only person involved in this company.
Well, I mean, beside that, that's not the standard. The standard isn't that whether he's the only person involved in the company. The standard is whether there's a willful and deliberate infringement on the trademark. There was no finding of that by the district court.
But doesn't
there
it say
no
in
evidence
in the record here? It does say that they did some studies and they made a conscious decision, notwithstanding the fact that there was this proceeding in the trademark board to carry on because their customers liked it better. Isn't that in the record here somewhere?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Okay.
Well,
but that doesn't mean that he's willfully and deliberately infringing. I mean, there's a whole set of facts that go into that. Did you know that they had ownership of this mark? You know, I mean, I can ask these questions that they should have asked. Did you know that they had ownership of this mark? What went through your mind when you decided to continue to market the name Hollow Wine? Did you believe that they did not have? Did you believe that they had ownership of the name Hollow Wine? Did you in deliberately go ahead and market this wine knowing that? I mean, those are all questions that should have been asked and should have been on the record if they wanted to hold him personally. They're not there. And it's not my obligation to ask those questions. The other thing is, I want to just get into one point quickly. There is no showing that Mr. Keene is responsible for the $500,000. There's no evidence as to what he personally profited from this in the record.
But that's your burden, is to say if they establish the gross sales, don't you have to then come back and say what the profit is?
They established gross sales for Illinois River Winery. They did not establish what Mr. Keene grossed out of this.
But is he not one and the same?
No. Oh. It's a company. There's a corporation. It's a company. That's like saying that the head of GM, who may have decided to infringe on something.
GM has 500,000 employees. Your company has one.
One full-time employee. But that's like saying that because Illinois River Winery profited X, that Mr. Keene profited X. Again, there's no evidence in this record anywhere as to what Mr. Keene profited.
Will the bankruptcy record shed any light on this?
As far as his position and the rest
of it? Question asked, ownership and so forth.
It might, but Judge, when you start talking about bankruptcy, my eyes gloss over.
Mm. Well, I mean, although we sort of passed over it in the beginning, it's going to have an impact on this case, I would assume.
And whatever's in its record is probably judicially noticeable too, in terms of what is, you know, at least what the outcome of the case is. So, to the extent that the bankruptcy, I think maybe where we're thinking about here is whether all these questions about whether Mr. Keene is in fact, you know, equal to his company, there might be something in that record that would indicate that.
Well, that'd be awful tough because, you know, we have no ability to come in here and discuss that any further, and so I think that would be a little bit unfair. But I'll sit down and I'll let these gentlemen talk, and I'll be back.
Thank you.
Hello.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to quickly make a quick point regarding the bankruptcy proceeding. As Mr. Casper mentioned, there is a pending motion to modify the automatic stay with respect to both appellants here. And just for the record, DPW does adopt the positions in its brief with respect to both appellants and agrees with the appellants that the stay didn't affect the argument or the disposition of the case. Judge Rovner, I'd like to turn also now to some of the questions you were asking regarding DPW's stay arguments. Frankly, we fundamentally disagree with Mr. Casper's view
of the law,
of what the law is regarding waiver. And in particular, his view that as the plaintiff, since we were the plaintiff, he was allowed to lie in the weeds, wait till he gets here, and raise any number of arguments that he didn't raise below. And that particular argument has been addressed by this court before and firmly rejected. In this court's Resolution Trust case from 1992, same argument was raised. The court said the defendant, quote, misapprehends the nature of summary judgment law, which does not permit a non-movement defendant to delay pointing out claimed flaws in the plaintiff's prima facie case until an appeal is underway.
Mr. Lira, I think you can go back to 1892, maybe 1792.
I agree with you, Your Honor. Sort of more recently, the Republic Tobacco case, same thing. Also, I thought it was interesting that Mr. Casper was pointing to trial practice, saying that if evidence wasn't put on at trial, his suggestion was you can do nothing, wait until you get to the Court of Appeals, and raise your arguments then. Of course, my view is that is not a good example for him to be raising. The Supreme Court in its Unitherm decision specifically said if a defendant is challenging the sufficiency of the evidence at trial and you do not present the arguments to the district court, then you cannot present them at the Court of Appeals, whether it's respect to JMAL or new trial or what have you. The rules in the trial case put that obligation on you, and if you don't make it, you can't make it here.
Would you agree that the argument as to whether Heilwine is a protectable mark has been preserved and not waived?
No, I wouldn't, Your Honor. Let me address that point. That was the next thing I wanted to address. Your Honor is correct that in their statement of facts that they put in, which had a variety of other procedural problems with it. Mainly it didn't respond to our statement.
But if I remember right, Judge Griesbeck said, I'm disregarding some of this, but he didn't say he was disregarding 15, 16, 17.
There were, in their statement of facts, some general statements about Google searches and what have you. The suggestion from Mr. Casper was that preserved an argument regarding the validity of the mark. Now, if you turn to their response brief in the summary judgment proceedings, there were certainly no arguments there that the Heilwine mark was generic or descriptive or what have you. So, for my view, simply putting some nebulous factual statements in the summary judgment fact response papers isn't preserving the argument. This sort of goes to cases you see, not only do you have to, drop something in a footnote or what have you, that if you want to preserve the argument, you actually have to make the argument. Mm-hmm. Putting that aside, our facts that we put in our, whether or not they're accepted as true or based on the evidence, what we put in and what the judge looked to, we think establish validity of the marks as on the undisputed facts. And they're undisputed.
Is that a fact question or a legal question? So Judge Griesbeck has a paragraph here on pages 14 and 15 that really basically that's the sum and substance of his analysis on protectable mark. It's at bottom of 14, top of 15. First question, is that a factual finding by the judge or a legal question, or is he taking undisputed facts, or is he construing the facts in the light most favorable to the other side and then deciding that, that this is suggestive? What do you make of that?
Well, the facts that we put in, which included our facts that were taken as true, but were also supported by Mr. Kane's deposition testimony, established that it's not generic and established the factual bases for suggestiveness, which leads to the conclusion as a matter of law that the marks are.
And what of their, are there, now, would you take it then that Judge Griesbach decided that that because they didn't present this argument in their briefs and they only presented it in their statement of facts, that that's the reason he didn't address paragraphs 15, 16, and 17 of their statement of facts, that suggests it's generic based on, as you say, these Google searches and the number of other people who are using Halloween as a term?
I wouldn't guess to sort of enter the district court's mind there. Certainly I don't think that he was obligated to mine the defendant's fact statement looking for possible arguments that they may be there. On top of that, law is also clear in the Bank Lumi decision from 1991 from this court that a defendant can't create an issue of fact by contradicting their previous sworn testimony. So in this case, you have Mr. Kane sworn testimony that it's not generic, that it is suggestive, and then later.
How does he know, though? He's not an expert in. Trademark, is he?
Well, he's an expert in, he's a person who's in the wine business, so he can offer evidence on whether it is generally, you know, a name that is commonly used to refer to this type of wine.
The suggestion
that it's generic just frankly doesn't make sense. I mean, they have the same product now. They call it Halloween. There's other sorts of, you know,
but they also call it isn't your company that has a product that's now called by the name of your winery, Halloween? Isn't that what they call it now?
Ours is called Halloween.
But it's the mark you have is somebody's Halloween. It's your company Halloween, right? Isn't that the mark they gave you?
We have registered marks that include Illinois or Door Peninsula Winery, Halloween, yeah, and also some graphics and other stuff. The mark that we're talking about here is just the common law rights in the word Halloween. That's the mark that we're talking about here.
Are you familiar with Christmas ale? There's something.
Sure.
So Christmas ale is this. This is just you know, we were doing a little surfing around the trademark trial and appeal board. So the same folks you were relying on to get this part way to your judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a company called Great Lakes Brewing Company that tried to get approval for to register the mark Christmas Ale, and the trademark and appeal board denied that because they said it was generic. What's the difference between Christmas Ale, which is a holiday plus a beverage, and Halloween, which sounds a lot like a holiday plus a beverage?
Well, the difference is that if you sought a mark, and again, this is certainly, I would say, removed from any arguments that the defendants have raised.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that makes the mark suggestive is really the pun that's involved in the name. They were not seeking a mark on Halloween wine, and that would be a totally different animal. I don't know if it would be generic exactly, but certainly, you know, perhaps descriptive. But when you get the word Halloween and you get the word wine and you put them together, so it's Halloween, that is not, it's a fantasy word. It's a made up word.
So if these guys at the Christmas Ale had blended Christmas and ale all together instead of putting a space between Christmas and ale, it would make a difference? It would be a Christmas sale, and it's a Christmas sale of ale.
Well, you know, I think the, you know, my client, when it came up with the name Halloween back in the late 90s, was fortunate to have a word, Halloween, that lent itself to this kind of wordplay with the word wine and put the two together to create the suggestive mark. there are any other questions, I'll give back the balance of my time to the court.
Thank you, counsel. How much time? You have 1 minute.
Justice, I think you set forth quite nicely the fact that the facts that they determined to find this name to be suggestive in paragraphs 35 through 38 of their findings of fact are all conclusions of law. There's not one fact in there. But I want to get into this notion of Mr. Keene being personally liable for 1 minute. Not only was there no special showing, it wasn't mentioned in the motion for summary judgment. It wasn't mentioned in the memorandum. It wasn't mentioned in the statement of proposed material facts. If you want to talk about having to mine for an argument that somehow Mr. Keene was personally liable for this, and if you want to talk about waiver, that stuff ought to be waived. The same thing of the showing on the profits by Mr. Keene being held personally liable and the profits by him. Wasn't argued, wasn't briefed, wasn't pled, and then they want to say in their response brief that he's jointly and severally liable. Again, that wasn't pled, it wasn't in the motion, there was no finding of that by the district court, and it's not even in the judgment. So given that, if there's any waiver in this case, it's by the plaintiffs in this case, as far as both of those issues, because none of that was pled, none of it was argued, and all of a sudden it's just assumed that these are judgments, that these should be in the judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be taken under...